beautiful. And it sounds as if it were written yesterday, but that music is over a century old. Music of Claude Debussy, that one I recognize, Pagodas, piano piece of Claude Debussy. At the beginning, we heard some music from Indonesia, specifically from either Bali or Java, gamelan music. Hello there. Welcome to Post Classical. I'm Bill McLaughlin. I'm in the studio today with Joseph Horowitz and Angel Gil Ordóñez. Great to see both of you gentlemen. This is going to be an interesting show. What are we doing here, Joe?
We're recapitulating a concert a few weeks ago at the Washington National Cathedral that we produced that narrated the story, surprisingly little known, of the impact of Indonesian music on Western composers. The gist of this story is that the non-Western musical genre, Bill, that's most impacted in our tradition is not African or Chinese or Indian. It's Indonesian. And to make it more interesting, there are two separate influences, Javanese gamelan, and we heard a little bit of Javanese gamelan, and Balinese gamelan. So we began the show, as you heard a part of, with the Javanese gamelan set with dancers, and the dancers, four of them, went down the nave, and they wound up in front of a piano. Mm-hmm. And when they stopped dancing, Wan Chi Su, our pianist, embarked on this music by Debussy. Debussy heard a Javanese gamelan in 1889 at the Paris Exposition, the same fair that gave us the Eiffel Tower, and it struck him as an epiphany. In fact, the Javanese village was a sensation, and the dancers were a sensation, and the music was a sensation. In 1889, you couldn't see a film of a gamelan or hear a recording of a gamelan. It came out of nowhere.
And so that's why Debussy went back again and again and again, and so did his younger compatriot, Ravel. The composers at that time were fascinated with his music. When we say gamelan music, it's music of Indonesia, but I looked this up just before we came in there. There are 17,000-plus islands in Indonesia, and we're talking about two or three, Bali, Java, and maybe Sunda. Tell us about the distinction in this music, and what was the effect on the French public, and then the world in 1892 at this exhibit?
There are many wonderful quotes from Debussy. I'll just read you one. My poor dear friend, do you remember the Javanese music, able to express every shade of meaning, even unmentionable shades, which make our tonic and dominant seem like ghosts? Their school consists of the eternal rhythm of the sea, the wind in the leaves, and a thousand other tiny noises that force one to admit that our own music is not much more than a barbarous kind of noise, more fit for a traveling circus.
Oh, my word.
Well, that gives you a starting point. And let's remember that this is a moment of kind of compositional crisis. The turn of the 20th century, composers are looking for a
new harmonic language, new way to express themselves. They've kind of chewed up tonalism, getting through Wagner, through Richard Strauss, through the tone poems and stuff like that. But I'm still interested in the music itself and the people who make it, because Indonesia is largely a Muslim land, but the people who make the Bali music sometimes have a Hindu background as well.
Well, we are going to get to the topic of Balinese versus Javanese in a moment with the help of Bill Alvis, who's our go-to guy. But before we get to Balinese music, let's spend a little bit more time with this event in 1889. Mm-hmm. I'll just share with you a few more reactions and then a thought about what it is that's so transfixing these people. Here's Camille Saint-Saëns. He says that it was a dream music that truly hypnotized some people. The four dancers, ages 13 to 17, became citywide celebrities. And a poet, Catou Imond, he wrote a couple of verses which are really, I think, vivid in capturing this hypnotic magic. They dance sacerdotally in their minute bird-like manner, and their hands over the gold web seem like fingered wings, moving their small boneless bodies, following a rite of fateful laws in the way waters slither and rattlesnakes undulate.
And so when Debussy made that piano piece, he wasn't exactly imitating gamelan, but he was inspired by it, wouldn't you say?
We get, in the course of this story, to composers like Colin McPhee and Lou Harrison, who are gamelan scholars. What Debussy is reacting to is not a close study of the music, but I would say three things. First, sound.
Mm-hmm.
Second, texture. The idea of a layered texture,
yep.
which nevertheless is not like Western counterpoint with its tension and release. And thirdly, there's a new social function mm-hmm. for music. It's a part of daily life. It's ceremonial. It's ubiquitous. He writes about that, too, as something that he finds intoxicating and stimulating.
So this is a music of a people. They're living there by the sea, surrounded by the sea, and it's an ancient culture. The Hindus were there before the inculcation of the Muslims, and so they bring with it, who knows where this music came from? Because there's nothing like this in Southeast Asia itself. There's nothing like this in India, for example, or Cambodia or Vietnam.
So this is the moment where we exhaust the knowledge in this room and call upon our friend Bill Halvis, who's with us from Southern California. Bill, can you enlighten us as to the roots of gamelan? And before we get to Balinese gamelan, which will be in a moment, talk about the difference between Javanese and Balinese gamelan music.
Sure. They both share the very similar instruments made of bronze, mostly gongs, metal key instruments. I don't think you would mistake the sound of one for the other. Javanese music is slow, typically contemplative, very beautifully sonorous. Balinese gamelan is very dynamic, loud, with great contrast, fast, and has this incredible precision. Both of them have these wonderful layers of polyphonic sound. As you pointed out, Bill, Bali still retains this ancient Hinduism and also the Hindu virtue of dharma, in which everyone fits into their place in society, their destiny. And that's in this music, as all of the intricate kind of interlocking patterns require this community cooperation. And also in the sense of cyclic time that echoes from South Asian cosmology that one finds in Hinduism.
Well, I'm interested. These two islands, Bali and Java, are very close together, aren't they?
Yeah, they're just separated by a short strait. Bali's much smaller, just to the west of Java. And Java encompasses several different traditions, but the one that we heard was the more famous gamelan tradition from central Java.
Gamelan is simply a word that means orchestra in that language, from what I gather. Is that correct?
That's right. It's this kind of orchestra. It doesn't refer to a specific instrument. It's this collection of these gongs and metal key instruments and a few others.
Mm-hmm. The characteristic differences in the sound between Java and Bali is very interesting. And I'm just astonished that these two highly distinctive musics could get formed so close together. I mean, it's just a few miles across that strait. You can probably, you can't throw a stone, but you could row across it in half an hour or something. And how could they be that different and so deep and so different from everything else in the world?
Maybe this is the moment to hear a Balinese gamelan. So, Bill, you found a clip for us. Could you tell us about it? And then let's hear it.
It's a very old piece that has gone through many versions and variations and styles called Tabu Tulu, which just literally means three strikes or three punctuations. It refers to the form. This was a piece that Colin McPhee, the Balinese music scholar, was inspired by that we'll also hear from.
Right. We're going to have the same exercise as at the beginning. We'll hear a little Balinese music and then an appropriation by a Western composer.
Okay. Thank you. stuff. That music started out with a sort of steady, I would transcribe it as eighth-note pattern, that kind of, what do you think, on how that
yep.
tick, 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 tick.
Very steady.
That dissolves, and then all heaven breaks loose. Not all hell. It kind of goes everywhere, and I can't think, how are they doing all this?
Yep.
The people on this island who are playing in this music, they have access to a very deep, ancient knowledge, which is completely foreign to us, opaque to us.
I totally agree. You know, one of the most extraordinary experiences for me of the performances we did is precisely to experience a life in the cathedral in such an extraordinary space, this incredible contrast.
Yeah.
Going from the Javanese gamelan, and then suddenly this craziness, this breaking loose all over the place. It's fascinating. What you actually ask, Bill, how is it possible, you know, just a few miles away in a complete different character? Is that true? Maybe, Bill, can you elaborate a little bit more on that? On is the people, how it reflects the character of the people, the way they approach the gamelan?
We're going to talk to Bill Alves,
our expert
in California. Yes. Bill Alves, what do you think about what we're kind of trying to come to grasp with this.
Exactly.
Help us out. You've been spending your whole life studying this music.
Well, part of the answer is historical and has to do with colonialism. From the 18th century, Java was under the control of the Dutch, but Bali not until the 20th century. And during that time, Bali was essentially isolated from the influences from its neighboring island.
Very interesting. Yeah.
So, first of all, how many instruments were we listening to right then? It sounded like a great, wonderful clutter of sound, just magical kind of rainbows of sound.
Yeah, we were hearing maybe 20 or 30 different instruments, mostly the bronze gongs and metal key instruments, but you also heard a kind of section of flutes in there, bamboo flutes, and a pair of drums.
Do people ever sing with this music or chant even?
Yes, but, you know, this music is so loud and boisterous. It's not as common as it is in Java.
So, Bill, you're recapitulating the fascination and amazement and incredulity of Colin McPhee when he discovered, first through recordings and then on the island of Bali, Balinese music, and asked the same questions you were asking now, except he resolved to answer them.
Just a minute. Who's this Colin McPhee character?
So he's the first person to notate this music.
Canadian, right?
He was born in Quebec. But imagine, until he shows up, everybody learns this music by ear, and they learned it in enormous precision and exactitude and complexity. Nobody had ever written it down before Colin McPhee came along and notated it and resolved to use it as a composer who had been struggling to find a voice. So he is on Bali in the 1930s. He creates his own gamelan there. And tragically, in 1938, he has to leave. We learn now it's because the Dutch cracked down on homosexuality, which had been widely tolerated. And I don't think he ever recovered from his exile from Bali. He succumbed to drink, depression. He would say things like, "The programs of new music that I once delighted in Paris and New York now seem suddenly dull and intellectual."
Mm-hmm.
But he did eventually get his act together. He lived a relatively short life. He died at the age of 63 in 1964, by which time he had composed three major orchestral works. You probably know Tabu Tabu Han, which was championed by Stokowski, which is from 1936. But I think the more interesting ones, which are much more of a fusion of East and West rather than just a transcription of what he heard on Bali, are the Second Symphony, Tabu Tabu Han being the First Symphony, and a work for chamber orchestra called Nocturne. But the vast majority of what he composes really comprises transcription. Probably the best known is a transcription of three dances for two pianos, best known because he recorded it with Benjamin Britten. So Britten comes to gamelan through McPhee. We did two of those, and before we get to his Nocturne and hear the music that he eventually composed, we'll hear this best known of his transcriptions. We'll hear two of the three ceremonial dances transcribed by Colin McPhee for two pianos. In our cathedral performance, the pianists are Benjamin Pasternak and Wan Chisu. Thank you.
Well, that's very interesting. Two piano pieces for two pianos, transcribed by Carla McPhee, based on what he heard on the island of Bali in the 1930s. Interesting, the first of those pieces is more complicated. The second one is more straightforward in my mind. And Angel, have you seen the score to this music?
I haven't, actually.
Were you trying to, I imagine you do, as I do. You're trying to imagine how to write it down.
Exactly, yeah.
And so what did you come up with? I would probably write it in quarter notes with maybe that 16th, something like that.
It makes sense, you know, to reduce that to 16 notes probably.
But then I was trying to think, okay, is there a downbeat that I can feel? Yes, there is sometimes, but then it seems to shift too.
Completely.
Yeah. What interesting, complicated stuff.
It is.
And so this is not McPhee's composition, but his transcription. So he's sitting there, probably not with a tape recorder. He's just listening, maybe making notes.
I do think that these are wonderful two piano pieces, transcriptions or not, and that their identity does shift.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, McPhee in his wonderful book, House on Bali, full of interesting details, some of them sociological, some of them musical, describes vividly how confounding Western music was to the Balinese musicians that he knew. They thought it was not even music, and they did not like the sound of a piano.
Huh. Probably not enough color change. You know, it's interesting. I know that book a little bit of Colin McPhee, and there's
a line
in it which I remember reading years ago when I was a kid. I think I had it from the New York Public Library. He's talking about these tempo shifts that Anho and I are so fascinated with. He said, look, have you ever seen a whole flock of starlings lift off from a marshland, and they're all headed east?
Beautiful image.
And then all of a sudden, they're headed west. They all did that at the same time. They said, that's the way these musicians move. It's like a force of nature.
It's a beautiful image. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's in that book. Joe, you're actually holding a copy of it. Tell us how people can read this.
I love this book.
House in Bali.
Just give you a little sample.
It?
It's Periplus.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most recent edition, the paperback. Here's a sample of his masterful prose. The melody unrolled like some ancient chant, grave and metallic, while around it there wove an endless counterpoint of tones from the little gongs in front. From time to time above the drums there floated the soft reverberating tone of a great gong, deep, penetrating, seeming to fill the temple with faintly echoing sound. The music came to an end, and the men laid down their mallets. They stared, but their gaze was not unfriendly. A young Chinese came up to speak a few polite words in English, and I began to question him. That's just a sample.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book, beautiful reminiscence. Now, Bill Alves, out there in California, straightening out on this, you mentioned that Bali had been isolated. It wasn't part of the Dutch enclave there in Indonesia, and that Colin McPhee left in 1938, sort of, persona non grata.
He risked incarceration. Had he stayed.
But I'm thinking this is an extremely interesting period between 1900 and I'm supposing the Japanese must have come down by 1940 or so.
Yes, the
1941, I think.
Right.
The impending war was also a factor in
this
department.
Right. And how much did that war, Bill Alves, change the way things were for these people?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it certainly did. But what really caused a great shift in Balinese music was the arrival of the Dutch beginning in 1904, who destroyed and massacred most of the courts that were in Bali. The court music that was much slower and maybe similar to that in Java became endangered, and instead many of those ensembles were melted down to make this new style that was very fast and lively and more popular, I guess, with the greater public.
Bill Alves, when you say melted down, did they actually melt down the bronze?
Yeah, literally melted down the bronze to make new keys.
Wow. And you call them keys, these instruments?
They're instruments that are made of bronze keys, that is, bronze rectangles, each tuned to a different pitch, like a xylophone.
Right.
And there are a great many of these instruments of different octaves in the Balinese gamelan, in addition to gongs of various sizes.
Well, McPhee is one interesting character. I wonder what drew him to Bali in the first place. When did he first arrive in
Bali? It
was
hearing recordings.
So he had heard some recordings in the early 1930s then, I'm guessing.
I think it was in the 20s, Bill Alves, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he describes that also I could read to you vividly in his book.
So where did he hear the recordings? I mean, he's living in New York City by this time. He'd abandoned Quebec. He's down in New York City. He's trying to be part of the avant-garde. Where I first knew of his music, Colin McPhee's music, he was trying to transcribe Native American music, Iroquois dances, as far as he could get close to them. Have you ever seen those pieces for orchestra?
No.
I don't find them terribly interesting because I guess it was mostly rhythm stuff that he was trying to transcribe.
So he tells us he was back in New York. I had heard the few gramophone records that were to change my life completely. He's talking the past tense about being in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing me out here in search of something quite indefinable, music or experience. The records had been made in Bali, and the clear metallic sounds of the music were like the stirring of 1,000 bells, delicate, confused, with a sensuous charm, a mystery that was quite overpowering. I begged to keep the records for a few days, and as I played them over and over, I became more and more enchanted with the sound. This story of Colin McPhee is a story we should know. And in fact, the piece we're about to hear, when we look back at it, The Nocturne, composed in 1958, we listen to it and we say, God damn, that sounds an awful lot like Philip Glass. In fact, he's now seen as a prophet of minimalism. I think this piece is a very high achievement as a compositional fusion.
Well, it's funny you bring up Philip Glass, because when we listen to the Debussy piece, which is called Pagodas, at the beginning of the show, the piano piece, so beautiful and so free. I was thinking, when I said it sounded like it was written yesterday, it presumes something over the horizon. Well, Debussy is an incredible genius and a very mysterious genius, but he sort of imagined where we would be in 1980 and 1990 and right now.
You know, when I was the executive director of the Brooklyn Philharmonic and Dennis Russell Davies was the chief conductor, we did an entire CD of Colin McPhee. And I will tell you, at that moment, I had no idea how important it was. I only realized it in retrospect. And from that CD, we'll now hear Dennis Russell Davies conduct the Brooklyn Philharmonic in Nocturne by Colin McPhee, 1958.
Thank you.
Remarkable music from Colin McPhee, an orchestral piece called Nocturne. That was the Brooklyn Philharmonic under my old boss for the Chamber Orchestra in St. Paul, Dennis Russell Davies, always devoted to whatever he was conducting and never more so than here. That's a beautiful performance, Joe.
One of the things I love about this late McPhee style is that it's melancholic.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear that in Balinese music. This is a guy, he was exiled from his paradise. He had lost the place where he felt at home. I don't think it's implausible to read that in to the tone of this music and also the Second Symphony.
Beautiful wind rating going back and forth, which is exactly those sections you're talking about.
A sense of loss.
Yeah, wow.
I hear a sense of loss.
You mentioned that McPhee recorded his piece we heard a little bit earlier for two pianos with Benjamin Britten.
Right.
And Britten wrote a wonderful piece called Prince of the Pagodas.
Right.
I guess that was the influence of McPhee upon him to some extent.
There's a long list, and it's our topic today, of composers influenced by Gamelan, Poulenc, Messiaen, Steve Reich, Béla Bartók, and many contemporary composers. So this is a huge story. There's no book about it. I don't understand why.
Well, Joe, you're an author. It's sitting there waiting for you, man. Write the dang book.
No, exactly.
It's too distant from my own field of expertise, but someone should write this book.
Well, you love it so much. I think that's the place to start. You've written on dance. You know something about dance, but not like a dancer or a choreographer. Write the dang book.
So that was our concert. We were sampling these different pieces by different composers, instruments by Gamelan, and we came up with a sleeper. The sleeper in our concert was the piece by Messiaen, the first of the Vision de l'Amen for two pianos, which I picked, not realizing the impact that it would have in live performance.
So let's see, Messiaen, it immediately brings to mind Birdsong, which is an important part. He loved Birdsong. He was trying to transcribe. It says the hardest thing in the world to write down, not that he ever quit trying. So what did that have to do with music of Bali? Maybe Bill Alves could help us out.
Just as with Debussy, a Balinese gamelan came through Paris during Messiaen's youth in 1931 as part of an exposition. And many composers and artists were fascinated by this culture at the time. And as you know, Messiaen, during the period of Nazi occupation, was taken off to a POW camp for a while, then returned to Paris. And the piece he wrote when he returned to Paris were these Vision de l'Amen. And this first piece takes the sounds of the Balinese bronze gongs and metal keys and the different layers of time and turns it into this kind of spiritual ecstasy of tollings of bells and transcendent spirituality.
I'm glad you say that, Villalbes, because when I heard the piece at the cathedral, the first piece that came to mind from Messiaen was the quartet for the end of the times, actually.
Yes.
So I didn't know that connection, and that actually, to me now, it makes total sense.
Yeah, that's the piece that Messiaen wrote while he was at the POW camp.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This piece is 1943, and we'll hear the same two pianists, Wan Chi-Su and Benjamin Pasternak, in live performance at the Washington National Cathedral.
I want to hear these gongs. Here we go. Here's music of Messiaen. Man, that's real space music for me. It really is. The two pianos are like two celestial objects in completely separate orbits, which come very close to each other. Occasionally, they align rhythmically, but it's sort of by chance. It's just because you stood in the right place and saw those two in the sky align.
Good image.
Yeah, but then they're out, and the tremendous chorale music, which is coming, which is largely kind of tonal. I even heard a couple major triads.
Sure.
It's an amazing piece of music. Music of Olivier Messiaen.
I had no idea it would have this impact in the cathedral. Yeah. But if you can imagine the great nave of the Washington National Cathedral, stained glass windows, and this music wafting through that space, it was something else.
Messiaen was a kind of godfather and teacher to much of the post-World War II serial avant-garde. But one thing that he said that music lacked was resonance. That he wanted to have a sense of resonance in his music.
Yeah.
And that's what you find in Gamelan in a really visceral sense.
Absolutely.
From the big gongs.
And there you are.
We just heard it, these chorale tunes in the middle register. You know, like thick chords, both hands thundering that out. It's wonderful.
So we now get to Bill Alvis as composer, whose Toccata completed a two-piano set. Bill, tell us about your piece.
Well, this was inspired by the same kinds of wonderful patterns that we've talked about in Balinese music, which I've played for many years. You can't do that without kind of falling in love with the intense sense of tight community that it enforces and invites, a community of people but of sound in which everyone has their own place to precisely fit into these patterns. So I have created a piece that also uses maybe the sort of approximation to one of the Balinese scales, a five-tone scale, but played entirely on the black keys of the pianos. So it's known as the black toccata.
And that would suggest pentatonic, because that five-tone scale, which is at the essence of many, many kinds of folk music, but particularly in our era, I think, of music of Asia.
So this is our same terrific duo of Wan Chisu and Benjamin Pasternak at the Washington National Cathedral, Black Toccata by Bill Alvis. Thank you.
Man, that piece makes me smile. Even before that genial mayhem at the very end. Black Toccata is the name of that piece. Black Toccata, having to do with the fact that it's played entirely in the black keys of two pianos. Music of Bill Alves. That's a terrific piece, man. But you know what? That repeated stuff requires of your pianist's wrists that would do credit to a Black & Decker paint shaker. Can you play this yourself, sir?
I'm afraid not, especially not like those two.
Yeah. It's wonderful, but it's lively, and it really does make me smile all the way through. And I could be an old grump sometime when I listen to the new music, but I love that piece.
Thank you.
So that's what ended part one of our program, and part two was all Lou Harrison.
And so with his marvelous performance of Bill Alves' Black Toccata, here endeth the first part of Post Classical. We'll be back in just a moment.